Chapter 6. A Fabricated Epidemic. By the mid-1980s, a sinister specter had been launched. The media buildup around AIDS, combined with the 1984 announcement of an AIDS virus, had painted a picture of a 20th century bubonic plague capable of ravaging our nation and the planet. Now everyone was aware of the deadly disease spreading through the homosexual community. The scientific and government experts, most prominently including Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, predicted an explosion into the heterosexual population. In early 1987, Koop and the World Health Organization were forecasting that a staggering 100 million people would be infected with the virus by early 1990. Talk of casual transmission became popular once top officials at the CDC and NIH announced HIV could be found in saliva. Evidence that the virus could survive for long periods outside the human body led to nervousness about restaurants and public toilets. Naturally, the fact that HIV was a blood-borne virus spurred discussion of mosquito transmission, including among top AIDS researchers. AIDS was such a new syndrome that most of its mysteries remained to be solved. Certainly no vaccine and probably no potent therapy would be available for several years, by which time hundreds of thousands or millions of people would already have died. In the meantime, it seemed that only public health measures could work. Authorities tried to prevent further spread of the illness by discouraging the major risk activities, those routes most easily transmitting HIV. The most obvious threat was said to be sexual intercourse. Official warnings were always accompanied by reminders that, although the virus was now transmitted by homosexual contact, it would soon follow the usual pattern of infectious diseases by spreading among heterosexuals of all walks of life. Frightening reports of the African epidemic were exploited to paint a picture of our own future. There, whole villages were apparently disappearing as the new syndrome cut a wide swath of destruction among men and women alike. In the industrial world, heterosexual intravenous drug addicts were already passing HIV around by sharing their used syringes. AIDS officials confidently reassured the public of their timely screening and protection of the nation's blood supply, but noted they were too late to save most hemophiliacs. Ominous statistics hit the news. 50% to 100% of everyone carrying the virus would die, and the unpredictable latent period between infection and AIDS ranged from 5 to 10 years, during which time the carriers could infect many more people. Once infected, an individual's antibody defense raised against HIV was inexplicably useless, except to alert doctors to the fatal infection. Once the virus was reactivated for unknown reasons, it proceeded to kill off the body's entire supply of T cells, the white blood cells regulating the immune response against all other microbes. AIDS victims suffered horribly, slow, painful deaths, being eaten alive by pneumonias, yeast infections, cancers, uncontrollable diarrhea, and dementia from brain degeneration. No recovery was possible since the patient was completely defenseless against many diseases normally harmless to a healthy person. To add a further sense of urgency, AIDS experts supplemented their official estimate of 1 million HIV-positive Americans with suggestions of 2 million to 3 million, plus dire predictions that the number might double every year. The public response to such news was inevitable. Battle lines rapidly emerged between two political camps, civil rights advocates for the HIV positives and those championing health rights for the HIV negatives. Under the banner call, Fight AIDS, Not People, groups ranging from the Militant AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP, to the federal government's National Commission on AIDS, insisted that the syndrome be treated basically as a handicap. Although acknowledging that AIDS was contagious, many political activists feared the potential backlash from widespread panic. They preferred to mobilize support for the care of AIDS patients, assiduously avoiding any hint of blame on the victims. As the National Commission on AIDS proclaimed, HIV disease has a devastating impact on those who are already marginalized members of society. HIV disease could not be understood outside the context of racism, homophobia, poverty, and unemployment. Likewise, President Bush admonished that once disease strikes, we don't blame those who are suffering. We don't spurn the accident victim who didn't wear a seatbelt. We don't reject the cancer patient who didn't quit smoking. We try to love them and care for them and comfort them. The CDC and other agencies deeply involved in managing the war on AIDS continued to warn of an imminent heterosexual epidemic. Activists for HIV were therefore forced to offer some solution to halt the syndrome's spread, but without endangering homosexual liberation. They found an answer in condoms and programs to provide heroin addicts with sterile needles. But many activists, including those in the National Commission, also saw in AIDS much opportunity. The HIV epidemic did not leave 37 million or more Americans without ways to finance their medical care, but it did dramatize their plight. The HIV epidemic did not cause the problem of homelessness, but it has expanded it and made it more visible. The HIV epidemic did not cause collapse of the healthcare system, but it has accelerated the disintegration of our public hospitals and intensified their financing problems. The HIV epidemic did not directly augment problems of substance use, but it has made the need for drug treatment for all who request it a matter of urgent national priority. Another side of the debate operated on the principle of better safe than sorry, viewing AIDS in more grand and threatening terms. This alarmism created strange alliances between such individuals as California Congressman William Dannemeyer and former Marxist, head of the U.S. Labor Party, Lyndon LaRouche. Many of these people were convinced the AIDS epidemic was actually far worse than officially acknowledged. They certainly had a rich source of raw material upon which to draw, including frequent quotes and numerical projections by federal officials. A 1985 book written by an investigator at the NIH provides a typical example. The AIDS virus shows every sign of being just as deadly as the plague during the Middle Ages. We are on a crash course with reality. This is not a practice run. There is no second chance. AIDS may be to the 20th century what the Black Plague was to the 14th century. The alarm must be sounded loudly and persuasively. If it is not, the conclusion is inescapable. Millions may die. Believing the population to be on the verge of decimation, a variety of alarmists called for strong public health measures by the government. Their reaction on behalf of the uninfected took on the strenuous tone of Jean Antonio, whose 1986 book, The AIDS Cover-Up, The Real and Alarming Facts About AIDS, became an underground bestseller. In the pell-mell rush to identify with the plight of AIDS sufferers, compassionate concern for the rest of society has been largely ignored. Permeated with heterophobia, AIDS victim identification hysteria has dangerously impeded compassionate steps being taken to safeguard the health of the rest of society. The alarmist generally insisted on mandatory HIV testing, particularly for healthcare workers and those in AIDS risk groups, as well as infection contact tracing and reportability to government agencies, and they even discussed possible quarantine of infected persons. More than 50 countries, including the United States, adopted immigration or tourism restrictions on infected people, and the Cuban government established a quarantine detention center for its HIV-positive citizens. Alarmists derided the weaker proposals of their opponents, often leaping to the defense of medical workers wanting more safeguards from potentially infected patients. Yet despite their differences, both sides of the controversy agreed on one thing. More money was needed to fight AIDS, and quickly. Federal AIDS officials were no doubt delighted to hear California Congressman Dannemeyer in an unusual alliance with Michigan Representative John Dingell for increased medical funding on AIDS declare enthusiastically, "The AIDS Prevention Act of 1990 is a path-breaking piece of legislation in many respects. For the first time, the federal government would make resources available to states, hospitals, high-risk clinics, and nonprofit healthcare facilities to provide preventative health services to low-income individuals afflicted with a specific disease, AIDS. This legislation breaks new ground in bringing federal resources to bear on a very specific national health problem, the epidemic of HIV infection. It includes many admirable provisions which, if enacted, would establish sound priorities and provide state and local health officials with appropriate resources to fight this horrible epidemic." This push for larger AIDS budgets certainly succeeded. Some $7 billion were spent by the federal government during 1994, and well over $35 billion has been spent since the AIDS epidemic began. What are the results of this modern-day Manhattan Project? A staggering 100,000 scientific papers so far have been published on HIV and AIDS, a number unprecedented for any other virus. But AIDS investigators have yet to demonstrate that even a single life has been saved by any of their programs. No vaccine exists, condom and clean needle programs have made no measurable impact on the epidemic, the admittedly toxic drugs AZT, DDL, and DDC, which do not cure AIDS, are the only therapy substitutes available today. Despite projections of widespread HIV infection has remained virtually constant throughout the industrialized world ever since it could be tested in 1985, whether in the United States or Europe, the estimated incubation period between infection and disease has been revised from 10 months to more than 10 years, and the predicted heterosexual explosion has failed to materialize. When a disease can be neither treated nor controlled, nor its course even roughly predicted, some fundamental assumption is probably badly askew. HIV not guilty. 20 years of belief in dormant human viruses causing disease after long incubation periods, plus many decades of hunting animal retroviruses, rendered most biologists utterly incapable of challenging Gallo's 1984 announcement of an AIDS virus. Prestigious awards and new grant monies awaited scientists who could apply their animal models or slow virus concepts to human disease. Researchers also felt insecure about venturing outside their narrow fields of specialization to raise questions in other areas. Epidemiologists assumed clinicians were accurately describing their cases. Virologists trusted the statistics of the epidemiologists, the immunologists placed confidence in the virologists' lab experiments, and the computer modeling experts believed them all. Any intrusion into another scientist's domain entailed peer rejection and humiliation. In this atmosphere of pressure to conform, the lessons of the bacteria-hunting era were easily overlooked. Virtually no one thought to test HIV according to Koch's postulates. These time-tested standards apply even more perfectly to viruses, which are non-living parasites with no behavioral flexibility, than they do to bacteria, which can sometimes release toxins or adapt to changing environments. The growing mountains of data on HIV were instead interpreted solely to fit the consensus virus, AIDS hypothesis, and researchers forgot the very rudiments of virology itself as they assigned increasingly bizarre properties to this virus. But Koch's postulates do indeed cut to the heart of the issue, exonerating HIV and rendering most AIDS research entirely pointless. 1. Koch's first postulate. The microbe must be found in all cases of the disease. Robert Koch explicitly stated that a causal germ would be found in high concentrations in the patient and distributed in the diseased tissues in such a way as to explain the course of the symptoms. In the case of AIDS, the affected tissues include the white blood cells of the immune system, particularly the T cells, as well as the skin cells in lesions of Kaposi sarcoma and brain neurons in dementia. But no trace of the virus can be found in either the Kaposi sarcomas or the neurons of the central nervous system. Since retroviruses in fact cannot infect non-dividing cells like neurons, the absence of HIV there is hardly surprising. However, because Kaposi sarcoma itself has long been synonymous with AIDS, the absence of virus in this cancer seriously undermines the HIV hypothesis. If HIV were actively infecting T cells or other members of the body's immune system, cell-free virus particles, known as virions, should easily be found with great ease circulating in the blood. This is the case with all classical viral diseases. In a patient suffering from hepatitis B, 1 milliliter of blood, about 5 or 10 drops, contains approximately 10 million free virus particles. Likewise, flu-like symptoms appear only in the presence of 1 million rhinovirus particles per milliliter of nasal mucus and 1 to 100 billion particles of rotavirus per gram of feces will accompany diarrhea in the patient. But in most individuals suffering from AIDS, no virus particles can be found anywhere in the body. The remaining few patients have at most a few hundred or a few thousand infectious units per milliliter of blood. One paper published in March of 1993 reported two individuals with about 100,000 virus particles per milliliter of blood out of dozens of AIDS patients with little or no detectable virus. Thus, HIV behaves as a harmless passenger microbe, only sporadically coming back to life long after the immune system has been destroyed by something else and can no longer suppress the virus. Even those patients with some detectable virus never have more than one in every 10,000 T cells actively producing copies of the virus. On average, only one in every 500 or more T cells contains even a dormant virus. The abundance of uninfected T cells in all AIDS patients is the fatal, definitive argument against the many false claims for high viral loads or burdens in AIDS patients. Nothing could ever stop infectious viruses from infecting all susceptible cells in the same body, except, of course, antiviral immunity. If T cells remain uninfected, there are no viruses to infect them. The absence of active infectious virus automatically disqualifies HIV as a player in the syndrome. Microbes can cause serious damage only when infecting the host cells faster than the body can replace them. T cells, the presumed target of HIV, are constantly regenerating at much, much higher rates than dormant HIV in the presence of antiviral immunity. To gain some perspective, one should remember that most people carry inactive forms of several viruses, none of which cause disease while the microbes remain hidden and dormant in the body. 2 out of every 3 Americans carry the herpes virus, and an equal number harbor the herpes class cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus causing mononucleosis, kissing disease, when active, resides in dormant form in 4 of every 5 Americans, and an even higher proportion of people host the papilloma or wart virus. If these viruses could cause disease while latent, the absurd situation would arise in which virtually no one would be left to treat the hundreds of millions of sufferers. HIV is not, of course, behaving differently from other viruses. Upon infecting a new host, a typical virus invades its target cells and begins replicating in large quantities, producing new virus particles that spill into the bloodstream and infect more cells. This is the period during which high levels of virus can be isolated from the patient and the symptoms are strongest. The body's immune system responds to the threat by mobilizing to mass produce the specific antibody proteins that attack and neutralize the virus particles. As this battle heats up, antibodies are produced more rapidly than the virus, ultimately eliminating active virus from the body. Most viruses are thereby completely destroyed, although some herpes viruses can establish chronic infections by hiding in certain tissues. Retroviruses by nature insert the genetic information into infected host cells, becoming dormant once neutralized by the host's immune system. HIV, like other retroviruses, can achieve high levels of virus when first infecting the body, up to 100,000 particles per milliliter of blood. But in most people, HIV is then permanently inactivated by the antibodies generated against it. During this brief period of HIV activity, some newly infected people have reported mild flu-like symptoms at most, but no AIDS diseases. But all of these rare cases were male homosexuals from high-risk groups, meaning people who had used recreational drugs that can cause exactly the same symptoms. Outside this risk group are the 17 million HIV-positive healthy people identified by the World Health Organization, who cannot connect any past disease with HIV infection. They are either surprised or shocked when they find out about being positive or blissfully unaware of it. The reason is that HIV is one of the many harmless passenger viruses that causes no clinical symptoms during the acute infection. By contrast, most people have lasting memories of their mumps, measles, hepatitis, polio, chickenpox, and flus, after which they become antibody positive for the respective viruses. AIDS patients, on the other hand, have generally been infected by HIV for years, not days, before they deteriorate and die. Thus, the virus has long since been neutralized, forcing doctors to test the patient either for the dormant virus or the antibodies against it. This is the operating principle of the HIV test, which identifies antibodies and yet, ironically, stands as proof of the innocence of this virus. Not all AIDS patients, however, carry even dormant HIV. Antibody-positive patients usually do have some latent virus left over from past infection, but many people dying of AIDS-like conditions, ranging from Kaposi sarcoma to immune deficiencies and various opportunistic infections, have never been infected by HIV in the first place. The CDC does not include most of these antibody-negative cases in its AIDS figures, rendering these people invisible. According to the CDC's own statistics, At least 2.5% of all official AIDS cases have never been tested for antibodies against HIV, many of whom might turn out to be negative. Further, the HIV test itself often generates false positive results, particularly in members of AIDS risk groups who have been infected with large numbers of interfering viruses. Thorough follow-up testing could reveal HIV-negative cases in the official AIDS tally. The scientific literature describes some 4,622 confirmed cases of HIV-free people dying of AIDS diseases, including homosexuals and heroin addicts in the United States and Europe and Central Africans. These dozens of studies generally found that among any group of clinically diagnosed AIDS patients, many test negative for HIV. But because the CDC ignores virtually all HIV-negative patients, counting only those with the virus as AIDS cases, the total number of such cases may never be known. Even a slow virus hypothesis of HIV cannot explain how uninfected people would develop AIDS conditions. From every angle, HIV fails Koch's first postulate. 2. Koch's second postulate. The microbe must be isolated from the host and grown in pure culture. This postulate was designed to prove that a given disease was caused by a particular germ rather than by some undetermined mixture of non-infectious substances. HIV has been isolated and is now grown continuously in HIV research labs. This rule, therefore, has technically been fulfilled, but only in some instances. Since free virus is rarely found in AIDS victims, HIV can be retrieved only from the great majority of them by reactivating the latent form of the virus. Millions of white blood cells must be taken from the patient and grown in culture dishes for weeks, during which time chemical stimulants that shock cells into growing or mutating are added to awaken any dormant HIV from within its host cells. Given enough patience and plenty of repetition of such procedures, a single intact virus can eventually be activated, at which point it starts infecting the remaining cultured cells. Yet even this powerful method does not yield active virus from many AIDS cases that have confirmed antibodies against HIV. Gallo himself faced this intractable problem, a frustrating situation that may have led him to claim Luc Montagnier's virus as his own. The situation is a mirror image of biological virus isolation that happens every time an uninfected person contracts the virus from an infected host. Natural transmission by unprotected sex has been studied in discordant couples, i.e. HIV-free women married to HIV-positive hemophiliacs or HIV-free male homosexuals having HIV-free sexual partners. These studies have revealed a rarely mentioned fact. After neutralizing the virus with the immune response, an HIV-positive person requires an average of 1,000 unprotected sexual contacts to pass this virus along just once. A pregnant mother is a different story. In effect, she provides her child with a 9-month continuous exposure to her blood and therefore has at least a 50% chance of passing HIV to the baby. HIV, as with any retrovirus, survives by reaching new hosts perinatally, mother to child, this being 500 times more efficient than by sexual transmission. This would explain why the numbers of HIV-positive people in America as well as Africa have remained so constant. HIV is transmitted from mother to child just like a human gene. This also reveals the reason for the virus being so widespread and equal between the sexes in Africa. HIV has been passed along from mother to child for many centuries, not through 1,000 heterosexual contacts, as is commonly assumed. In the industrial world, HIV can be readily transmitted only among the most sexually active homosexuals, among needle-sharing addicts, and through blood transfusions to hemophiliacs, the routes that so easily transmit numerous other microbes. In short, the very people with tremendous health risks to begin with also more easily pass along HIV, making it a surrogate marker for the real cause of AIDS. Therefore, a rough correlation exists between HIV and AIDS diseases, but it is imperfect and misleading. The extremely low efficiency of sexual transmission explains the failures of Gallo, Weiss, and other leading AIDS researchers in isolating HIV. Even for the most experienced virus hunters, a virus that is not present is difficult to find. Only rare luck or misfortune, depending on one's purposes, and extreme persistence can extract HIV from an antibody-positive person. The very ability of retroviruses to survive as dormant genes by attaching themselves to human chromosomes has been exploited for the most sensitive HIV assay yet, the polymerase chain reaction, PCR. This incredibly sensitive technique was invented in the mid-1980s by Berkeley biochemist Katie Mullis, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for his discovery in 1993. The PCR is a technology that amplifies even the tiniest amounts of any specific DNA sequence, creating enough copies of the desired sequence for detection and analysis. This amounts to finding the proverbial needle of dormant HIV in a haystack of human DNA. But contrary to statements by some HIV scientists, this is not an isolation of the actual virus and does not fulfill Koch's second postulate. It is only the detection of dormant DNA genomes or fractions of viral genomes left behind from infections that occurred years earlier. Nevertheless, scientists and journalists alike sometimes mislabel such exhumations of viral fossils as new, more sensitive techniques that somehow prove HIV can be found in an ever greater portion of AIDS patients. Because a few HIV molecules are technically invisible, but millions of HIV molecules are visible, Mullis's PCR technique has become the only practical method to detect viral molecules in all those antibody-positive people in which no virus can be found. 3. Koch's third postulate. The microbe must reproduce the original disease when introduced into a susceptible host. The official HIV-AIDS hypothesis declares a 50% to 100% probability of death from infection. In practice, scientists and medical doctors interpret antibodies against HIV as a sure sign of imminent doom. This notion of antibodies as a prognosis of death defies all classical experience with viruses and bacteria. Virtually every microbe causes disease in only a minority of infected individuals, since the majority are usually healthy enough to mount a rapid immune response. Certainly, no fatal viral disease is known to cause death in nearly all infected people, except the paradoxical AIDS virus. Any microbe killing all its hosts would soon destroy itself, even if such could exist in the first place. Any germ must be able to reach new hosts before the previous one dies, lest it go down with a sinking ship. Any universally lethal parasite would be, by definition, a suicidal organism. HIV would face even less chance of survival, being extremely difficult to transmit from one person to another, and would thus usually die with its infected host. Traditional incubation periods, defined as the time between initial viral infection and the onset of disease symptoms, are measured in days or weeks. During this period, the virus multiplies into concentrations high enough to cause disease. The process is exponential. Each virus particle infects a single cell, and 8 to 48 hours later, hundreds of new virus particles begin to be produced, each destined to infect a new cell. Flu, common colds, and herpes simplex infections develop with short incubations lasting between a few days and weeks. Measles, chickenpox, and rubella have longer incubations of 10 to 20 days, while extreme conditions, such as hepatitis, can take 2 to 6 weeks. These delays occur before the body has launched an immune response against the new virus. Because these delays or latent periods are determined entirely by the generation time of the virus, and the generation time of HIV is about 48 hours, we can calculate how soon after infection AIDS should appear. Natural infection only introduces a few viruses into the body, but just one infected cell produces at least 100 offspring within 2 days. These in turn will produce 100 times 100 within 2 days. Such exponential or explosive growth will produce 100 trillion or 1,014 viruses in just 2 weeks, enough to infect every cell in the human body. Therefore, HIV should cause AIDS within a few weeks of infection. But borrowing from their cancer research, virus hunters officially give HIV 10 years between infection and the onset of AIDS, years after antibodies have neutralized the virus. Such latency periods have been invented solely to circumvent Robert Koch's third postulate. But any germ not causing symptoms before being cleared by the immune system should be ruled out as causing disease. Koch's third postulate insists on reproducing the disease in at least some cases by injecting the allegedly dangerous microbe into a number of uninfected and otherwise healthy hosts. This condition can be tested in one of three ways: infection of laboratory animals, accidental and natural infection of humans, deliberate infection would be unethical, or by vaccination experiments. HIV fails all three tests. A. Blood from AIDS patients was injected into several chimpanzees in 1983, before the availability of HIV tests. The animals were infected by HIV, as later evidenced by antibodies against the virus, but in 10 years, none has yet developed any sickness. Roughly 150 other lab chimpanzees injected with purified HIV since 1984 have proved that antibodies against the virus are generated within a month of inoculation, just as in humans, but again, none has developed symptoms to this very day. In short, no animal becomes sick from HIV, although monkeys and other test animals do suffer disease from human viruses causing polio, flu, hepatitis, and other conditions. By the end of 1992, the CDC had reported some 33 medical workers as most likely having received HIV accidentally, of whom 7 were diagnosed with AIDS symptoms. None of these reports has been confirmed with published medical case histories, although in a 1989 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, an informal editorial entitled "When a House Officer Gets AIDS" was written by a doctor infected by a patient. The article describes only minor weight loss of 10 pounds and a bit of fatigue as being the doctor's AIDS complications. This hardly counts as evidence for Koch's third postulate, nor has the CDC stated whether any of these medical workers have taken the dangerously toxic AZT, the official AIDS treatment, which itself causes immune deficiency. B. During the past decade, more than 400,000 AIDS patients have been treated and investigated by a system of 5 million medical workers and AIDS researchers, none of whom have been vaccinated against HIV. Doctors who have treated AIDS patients were initially admired by their peers and the press for their courage to face a fatal, contagious condition for which there was no cure, no drug, and no vaccine. But 10 years later, there is not even one case in the scientific literature of a healthcare worker who ever contracted presumably infectious AIDS from a patient. Imagine what it would have been like if 400,000 cholera, hepatitis, syphilis, influenza, or rabies patients had been treated by healthcare workers for 10 years without protection from vaccines and antimicrobial drugs. Thousands would have contracted these diseases. This is exactly why we consider these diseases infectious. The complete failure of 400,000 AIDS patients to transmit their diseases to even one of their unvaccinated doctors in 10 years can mean only one thing: AIDS is not infectious. However, several thousand healthcare workers have by now been diagnosed with AIDS, but these individuals belong to the same AIDS risk groups as 10% of all AIDS cases, homosexuals and intravenous drug users. And although 3/4 of all healthcare workers are female, more than 10% of these AIDS patients are male, the exact same ratio as with all other AIDS cases. In other words, medical accidents are not producing the expected AIDS epidemic among unvaccinated personnel in that industry. Nor has HIV affected the recipients of blood transfusions, most notably hemophiliacs. Some 15,000 hemophiliacs in the United States, about 3/4 of the total, were infected with HIV before screening of the blood supply began in 1984. But also, during the past 15 years, improved medical treatment has doubled their median life expectancy. The virus AIDS hypothesis would have predicted that now, 10 and more years later, more than half of them would have died from AIDS. Instead, fewer than 2% of these HIV-positive hemophiliacs develop AIDS each year. According to several dozen small studies, this matches the rate of immune deficiencies and death among HIV-negative hemophiliacs, a phenomenon apparently related to hemophilia itself. See, the third postulate can be tested in humans through a reverse method. If vaccines or other techniques can be used to provoke the body into neutralizing the microbe with antibodies and the disease is thereby prevented, the germ has been proven guilty experimentally, But since AIDS is found in each patient only after the immune system has already suppressed HIV, the virus plays no role. Most AIDS researchers have conveniently forgotten this important principle and continue to blame the virus when only antibodies against it can be found. Others blatantly reverse the logic of the vaccination test, declaring antibodies useless because they do not prevent AIDS. D. The acid test of Koch's third postulate would be to infect newborn babies with HIV because newborns are immunotolerant and thus much more susceptible to a virus than adults. It is known from experiments with animals that a virus is totally harmless if it does not cause a disease in newborns. It would, of course, be unthinkable to inject HIV experimentally in human babies to test whether it causes AIDS. Yet exactly this experiment has already been done millions of times by nature to generate most of the 17 million healthy but HIV-positive people living on this planet. Most of these people picked up HIV by natural infection from their mothers. Indeed, all animal and human retroviruses, including HIV, depend on mother-to-child, perinatal, transmission for survival. Since sexual transmission is extremely inefficient, depending on 1,000 sexual contacts in the case of HIV, retroviruses could never survive by sexual transmission. They can only survive by perinatal transmission, which is about 50% efficient. Therefore, perinatal transmission must be harmless, or else the baby, the mother, and the virus would not survive. HIV would be a kamikaze killer. It would kill itself together with its host. If that were true, one would expect thousands of healthy young American men or women to have HIV but not AIDS. That is exactly what the U.S. Army reports. The U.S. Army tests all applicants and all its young men and women annually and identifies thousands of HIV positives who are totally healthy. While some of these might have acquired their virus sexually, it is impossible that thousands would have had the 1,000 sexual contacts with HIV positives or the 250,000 sexual contacts with average Americans, of which only 1 in 250 is HIV positive, that are necessary to pick up HIV by sexual transmission. Therefore, most of these HIV-positive young men and women must have acquired HIV from their mothers 16 to 20 years prior to their application to the U.S. Army. This same must be true for most of the remaining 17 million humans who are healthy and HIV-positive. The fact that millions have acquired HIV at birth, yet are healthy adults, is the most devastating argument against the HIV-AIDS hypothesis. It proves that HIV, like all other microbes that are transmitted perinatally or sexually, cannot be fatally pathogenic. Indeed, no fatally pathogenic microbe exists in animals or humans that depends either on perinatal or sexual transmission for survival. No matter how one looks at the HIV hypothesis, it is flawed either in terms of facts or in theory or in both. E. Koch's third postulate can also be tested provisionally on human cells in culture. If HIV cannot induce disease in whole organisms, one might at least expect it to kill T cells grown in laboratory culture dishes, where the concentrations of actively replicating virus are enormously high. Robert Gallo, however, has been able to patent the virus by growing it continuously in immortal T cell cultures since 1984. The French discoverer of the virus, Luc Montagnier, reported occasional cell death in infected cultures that was stopped by adding antibiotics, which do not affect virus replication, but do kill undetected bacterial contaminants. Indeed, the HIV antibody test is made from virus that is mass-produced in T cells, which grow continuously rather than die. The reports from other labs and biotechnology companies are consistent. HIV grows harmoniously with the cells it infects. The failure to kill T cells, even under optimal conditions, is the Achilles heel of the supposed AIDS virus. HIV typifies a retrovirus in every measurable way. It has the same biochemical structure and infective properties, benignly stimulating some cells to produce more copies of the virus. It has the same amount of genetic information and the same three basic genes as all other retroviruses. It also has six smaller genes, themselves a normal feature of other retroviruses. Although many HIV researchers focus their efforts on studying these extra genes as possible AIDS genes, No one gene is unusual, and all are needed for virus survival. HIV contains no special AIDS gene expressed during the syndrome. However, this does not stop industrious AIDS scientists from endlessly re-examining the genetic sequences for some magical clue to explain AIDS. HIV clearly fails Koch's postulates. However, virologists should have expected this from the beginning. HIV is, after all, a retrovirus, precisely the kind of virus so benign to its host cells that it had inspired such hope in the war on cancer, since cancer cells grow and behave uncontrollably rather than die. Retroviruses have never been known to inhibit or kill billions of rapidly dividing cells and could hardly be expected to affect T cells or otherwise destroy the immune system. To be the cause of AIDS, the virus would require still more miracles. A number of the AIDS indicator diseases are not opportunistic infections preying on an immune-deficient host, including dementia, wasting syndrome, and the various AIDS cancers, Kaposi sarcoma, the lymphomas, and, as of 1993, cervical cancer. Altogether, these non-immunodeficiency AIDS diseases made up 39% of all American AIDS diseases in 1992, and owing to a new definition of AIDS, 20% of all AIDS diseases in 1993. HIV would have to kill T cells while destroying brain neurons it cannot infect, and at the same time induce white blood cells and skin cells to grow malignantly. To reconcile these non-immunodeficiency diseases with HIV, AIDS scientists would like to blame even these diseases on immune suppression. But despite years of research, no evidence can be found that the immune system fights cancer cells, which, after all, are part of the host's own body. In fact, dozens of AIDS patients with Kaposi sarcoma or dementia have been reported to have normal immune systems. So HIV would indeed have to accomplish many incredible tasks at once. Stranger still, infants with AIDS suffer immune suppression from deficiencies in B cells, a subgroup of white blood cells altogether different from T cells. Since there are no precedents for cell-killing retroviruses and no laws other than Koch's for convicting viruses for a disease, even the HIV orthodoxy admits that their hypothesis stands unproven. However, they insist that Koch's not guilty verdict of HIV does not prove HIV innocent, and that further work will eventually prove HIV guilty. No matter how convincing the HIV-AIDS paradoxes should be, official AIDS scientists cannot be dissuaded from their virus hypothesis. When forced to answer the above arguments, their imaginations run wild in designing ever new variations of the same experiments to prove their hypothesis. According to HIV advocate John Maddox, the remedy is not, of course, to pander to wish fulfillment, but to redouble effort in the laboratory and the clinic. But these experiments have only proven to this date that HIV hypothesis is impossible to prove.